Aloha and welcome to Not Figments, the Power of Imagination, where you usually see me on ThinkTech Hawaii. Today I'm subbing for Jay Fidel on Military in Hawaii, which is an effort brought to you by the Military Affairs Council of the Chamber of Commerce. And it's really an important organization you may not know about, so let me give it a quick plug. I've been associated with it in various roles since I got back to Hawaii in 2005 as the deputy commander of PACOM. They're advocates for everybody, not just the military, for everybody. And so they bring this series to inform folks on things that matter. Military matters, get it? See what I did there? Things that matter to our Ohana and our Aina. So today, what are we going to talk about that matters? We're going to talk about one of my very favorite topics, women, peace, and security. A formal program that is an asymmetric advantage for the U.S. in the Indo-Asia-Pacific region. And I'm really fortunate to have as my guest today Monica Herrera, who is the Indo-PACOM WPS, Women, Peace, and Security, and I'll use that acronym a lot, Curriculum Developer Manager for Indo-PACOM. Monica, aloha. How's it?
Aloha. It's going really well. Thank you so much for having me today.
And we connected through the Military Affairs Council, but we're like-minded. So if I seem biased in favor of the guest today, it's because I am, because women, peace, and security is something that I cared a lot about as a director at APCSS. I'll try to be a bit of a devil's advocate voice, but you all know what I really think. I think this is an asymmetric advantage. Before we get to the real topic at hand, Monica, I know you're a Air Force Academy graduate, which puts you intellectually and in every other way a level above me, since I applied and they laughed. How did you wind up applying for the Air Force Academy, and where did you come from? Where's home originally?
Yeah, I grew up in Southern California in Orange County. And some folks may know it is water polo is a very popular sport there. And the way both my brother and I ended up at the Air Force Academy was actually through water polo. So he went 2 years before I did and was recruited onto the men's water polo team. And that was really my opportunity to see what the Air Force Academy was all about. So I had the chance to go for Parents Weekend when he was a freshman and get a better feel of kind of what the Air Force Academy offers. And that was it, you know, and then I was all in. So I was very grateful for that experience.
Did you have any family connection to the military and especially the Air Force, or was it just a good school, which it is, with a good athletic program?
We don't have any family connection to the military at all, actually. And I think if we hadn't had that kind of firsthand experience, someone that we knew, so the men's head coach at the Air Force Academy had been at the men's water polo team, had been the head coach at our high school for the boys team. And I think if we hadn't had that kind of personal introduction to what a military academy was all about, neither of us probably would have known that it was even an option. So we're very grateful for that and for the experience.
Was it pretty rigorous academically? He says, tongue slightly in cheek.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's balancing the academics with the athletics and the military leadership opportunities that definitely made it both a challenge, but also incredibly rewarding experience.
Yeah, it's not quite the free pass that you might get at some institutions for being a good athlete. You got your bachelor's degree in, I'm looking here, I have it here. So what's your bachelor's degree in, Monica?
It's in behavioral science.
And then you went on to get a master's in sociology from Rutgers, a good Big Ten school now, which is kind of weird. There it is. And you minored in Japanese. Did you have an Asia Pacific bent to you that made you take a language that I find more difficult than Chinese or Korean? Why
You know,
Japanese?
actually, I had taken Spanish in high school, but there are only
Muy
so many
bien.
slots for freshmen to take Spanish at the Air Force Academy. So when they were like, no, Spanish isn't available, I kind of chose a language that I knew was going to introduce me to a different kind of culture and a different region
Right.
that I hadn't really known about before. And sure enough, yeah, I really enjoyed it. I had the chance while I was a cadet to visit Japan on a language immersion program. And I, you know, minored in Japanese. And actually, I just got back from Japan, helping support a U.S. Army Japan Women, Peace, and Security Symposium, a
Great.
bilateral symposium with our Japanese allies. So that was really exciting.
Well, there's more to it than that. You actually work for the woman politician, political leader in Japan, who's now the mayor of Tokyo. So your Japanese must be pretty good. I'm
It's
thinking.
not, unfortunately. You were right. It's a very hard language. So despite the Japanese minor and despite having spent some time there, a year
Wow.
living there while on a Mansfield Fellowship program, yeah, it's I mean, I can get around, but my grammar is a little rocky.
Japanese, I was at Kadena for 4 years and spent 4 years in Korea and a lot of time in the rest of Asia. Japanese just, it never stuck to my brain like some other languages, though I'm not a scholar or a good student. And so, for example, today is Spanish Thursdays, huevos de Espanol here, not huevos, not eggs of Spanish. See what I did there? In our household, so I'm locked in my room, my office, doing an episode of Military in Hawaii, so I don't have to speak Spanish out in the household with my family from Chile. But you were a behavioral scientist in the Air Force. What does a behavioral scientist in the Air Force do? What, when you were in the field and not teaching at the academy or doing a fellowship in Japan, what was your job?
Yeah, so the behavioral scientist career field sadly no longer exists.
What?
But the story doesn't end there. I will say when I
Right.
started, it's not a clinical psychology type of
Right.
work that I think people normally think of. It's really mostly research-based. So I was stationed at the Air Force Research Laboratory, and we were doing research on, physical and cognitive performance. So whether it was testing, nutritional supplements or sleep schedules or different kinds of physical training programs to try to optimize human performance. So it's part of the human performance wing within the Air Force Research Laboratory. So yeah, I ended up only doing that for 3 years, and then I got picked up for my
Only
master's
3 years.
degree. I went back to teach, and then once I went on the Mansfield Fellowship program in Japan, I became a foreign area officer. But then I was able to actually switch my primary career field. So I'm now an information operations officer, which is really understanding human cognition and how that affects decision making within the information environment. So I continue to do that as a reservist, also at Indo-Pacific Command.
So that's kind of a loop back to behavioral scientist, right? And it's
Sure,
all
yes.
about optimizing performance as individuals and organizations. That's my assessment. Am I close to right?
Yes, absolutely. And I think also understanding, right, getting into the kind of decision-making cycle, understanding, especially within the information environment, how people make decisions and how we can use that to our benefit when we're planning operations.
And that can sound pretty dark, frankly, to an outsider who doesn't understand what the U.S. military does in the region. But it's not psychological warfare. It's about being able to interact and relate to your counterparts who come from different cultures and countries and languages and everything else. Be respectful of their background while promoting U.S. values and priorities. And so this human side of it is really important. And that brings us to women, peace, and security, which I have to say at the outset is not men, war, and insecurity. It's about using the view of women, the participation of women, the perspective of women effectively in security matters. Okay, if I described that incorrectly, please correct me, Monica, and go on with a little bit more of a summary of what WPS is.
Sure. So you got it absolutely right. WPS, the International Women, Peace, and Security Framework, really started from a UN Security Council resolution. So Resolution 1325, which was unanimously adopted by the Security Council back in October 2000, and was the first resolution to acknowledge the disproportionate impact of conflict and crisis on women and girls and really seek to include their perspectives and voices and really just increase women's meaningful participation across peace and security sectors in order to achieve more sustainable peace.
1325, as a behavioral scientist, you probably know that I somehow got it imprinted in my brain over time as 1351, but I'm corrected again. This sounds like some sort of politically correct social engineering baloney, some might say, but it really works, I think. Do you think it really works? And why does it really work to involve women in security matters more fully?
Great question. And, you know, I would just start by saying, first and foremost, women make up half the population and they deserve the right, to be at the table when decisions are being made about, how to define safety and security, and when decisions are being made about their own safety and security. So this is an international agenda. It actually, emerged out of the wars in Bosnia and Rwanda from women in those nations who were demanding a seat at the table. And so this is not a U.S. agenda. Mm-hmm. This isn't even a Western-led agenda. This is an international framework. And there continues to be growing and solid empirical evidence that when women participate, peace is more lasting. And that goes from everything from peace agreements to peace negotiations, and even just the status of women as a kind of indicator of peace within a particular nation. So we actually see that where there's greater gender inequality, nations are actually more likely to threaten or use force or go to war, whereas we see more sustainable peace and stability in nations where there's greater gender equality.
Let me mansplain that to the viewers who, like me, may be toxic males and unable to fully comprehend it. Duh. You can't expect to have effective security policies and implement them in an effective manner if you don't involve half the population. And the alternate voices, the different viewpoints will keep you from doing stupid, I'll say stuff. You guys know what I'm thinking, though. And it really is obvious to me. I have to share a vignette about a conflict resolution workshop that actually was at a seminar that I participated in when I was the director at APCSS. And I was asked how, in this case, or in this event, I was asked, how could it be that Japan chose to attack the United States? And my answer is very simple. Look at the room. Look, for you Hamilton fans, who was in the room? Well, it was all men, all like-minded men from similar background. It isn't their gender necessarily that biased the discussion. It's the lack of other viewpoints. And those other viewpoints, now I'm on my soapbox, Monica, please forgive me. If those other viewpoints don't get to get on the soapbox, don't get to participate in the discussion, you're going to do stupid stuff. I'm just saying. Agree? Disagree? Please agree.
Absolutely. And you bring up a great point. It's not that women are necessarily inherently more peaceful, and certainly it's not that women all have the same experiences and are bringing a singular perspective to get together. They all represent diverse viewpoints. And kind of really, when you think about it, women's voices, mm-hmm. they're just critical to providing a more holistic understanding of the security landscape. And, the way I describe it to a lot of our, defense audiences during our training, right? No military commander would be satisfied with a 50% picture of the operational environment, right? So why would we tolerate a security sector in which half the population continues to be so underrepresented?
That's a great analogy that I will feel free to pilfer from you, because I've been a commander in combat. And if my intel folks came to me and say, sir, we've got great satellite imagery of half the battle space, I'm pretty sure I'd be unhappy. So what does your your role sometimes is to go be a gender advisor during operations in the field. What's a gender advisor do? And then I'll put a scenario to it and ask you to explain further.
Yeah, that's another great question. So I think Department of Defense has really made significant strides in WPS implementation by training up gender advisors and gender focal points across DOD. And we really are training them to do what we say, what we call operationalizing a gender perspective.
Right.
And really what that means is understanding that men, women, boys, and girls, diverse populations, they experience conflict and crisis in different ways. And so that really means that they have different immediate needs and long-term interests. And that's kind of based in large part on gender roles, especially those gendered considerations, right? Gender roles, rights, responsibilities, expectations, behaviors. So really operationalizing a gender perspective means recognizing gender as a key characteristic of the operational environment and then using that knowledge to inform mission planning. And so that's, you mentioned, yes, I supported Operation Allies Welcome. These were the U.S. efforts to resettle Afghan evacuees after the evacuation of Kabul. And we were resettling evacuees here in the United States. And we had initially 8 safe haven locations located on 8 different military bases, housing up to 10 to 13,000 Afghan evacuees. And so during that resettlement process, DOD gender advisors were brought in because it was largely the military personnel who were supporting those operations.
Right.
They were doing things like logistics, housing, food and supply distribution, transportation. And oftentimes these kinds of activities are seen as gender neutral. But when you actually do conduct what you call a gender analysis and you look at the fact that there is the potential for inequitable access to these kinds of relief and recovery resources, to these experiences, to understanding the safety and security of the entire affected population. That's really what a gender advisor does. We conduct gender analysis, we lay this analytical framework, and then integrate it into the military planning process. So into, you know, the orders writing process, all of those kind of very military specific tasks that help ensure that our personnel are providing equitably for the entire affected population.
And for men who might go, well, gender neutral is good, it's fair, right? Or women who might say that. Imagine putting one of your family circle of the gender you aren't into an environment that's totally gender neutral. Wouldn't you want some consideration for their unique requirements, their gendered requirements, gender-based safety and stuff like that? I think you would. So, imagine that I'm a commander at a, let's say, humanitarian, really, we won't use the safe haven example. I'm a commander somewhere in the area of responsibility of Indo-Pacific Command. And the problem is a humanitarian disaster, could be an earthquake, flood, mudslide, volcano, that it has on the fringes a terrorism threat. And you come in and introduce yourself, knock, knock, doc. Hi, I'm Monica. I'm your gender advisor. What do you say to me from the outset when I look up from my desk or whatever with a raised eyebrow? What is your opening pitch?
Well, the way we train, right, before you go into that meeting, the first thing that a gender advisor will do is identify the commander's priorities, right? And our job is to support the commander in whatever he or she has stated they are trying to do. So if that's to, let's say, safely move a population from one place to the next or provide security for a particular area, we will go in and say, here are the potential gender considerations associated with this mission. My job as the gender advisor is to make sure that you as the commander are successful in that mission that you've stated by taking gender into consideration and ensuring that we take that into our military planning process so that any of our interventions are going to be more effective.
Okay, so as the commander, one of my stated priorities is to understand the fears of the Serb population because they're afraid because we've had this disaster, the terrorism. Any thoughts on how you'd tell me to fully understand the gender spectrum of fears, if you will? I'm not sure I said that clearly, but how do we do that? Because the men I'm dealing with, the local militia, let's say, and police are probably mostly men. How do I get the other genders' views on the fears and concerns?
Great question. And this is where a gender analysis actually comes into play, which is what we train our folks to do. And that would be, so the first step would be, you know, conducting the gender analysis for that particular local population. So what are those gender dynamics that might be affecting whether or not we're hearing from the entire population? Maybe women in that culture are not allowed to speak directly to men outside of their family, as an example. So how are we going to be able to access the perspectives of the entire population? Let's say we're only sending in engagement teams that are all male. That would be a potential solution. Let's look at the makeup of our engagement teams to ensure we have the right mix of folks that will be able to access the entire population so that we can get that better full scope of the picture when it comes to identifying the security needs and the safety concerns of the entire population. That would be just one example.
Okay, let's take that very male focused led environment that you described. I hate to say male dominated because you know, it's not that women don't have a role in society. In this case, it's not a public role, but we're doing public work, providing humanitarian assistance and perhaps some mitigation of the terrorist threat now. And I've bought into you as my gender advisor, and now we're having a meeting with the local authorities who happen to be all men. They are all men. And I've got you with me because I trust you as my gender advisor. And I say to the folks we're trying to help, this is Monica. She's my gender advisor. And she wants to do, what do you want to do? What do you say to these men who are kind of raising the eyebrow again and confronted with a situation they may not be comfortable with? I mean, let's just recognize that may be uncomfortable for them.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think the first thing is always trying to appeal again to what it is that the audience that you're discussing, what are they very interested in? And so in that case, if the men are interested in ensuring that their entire population is effectively protected, then really it's just, well, we want to make sure that we are representing perspectives of the entire population. And some of the things that you can do potentially before that meeting happens is ask for the inclusion of especially civil society organizations that are on the ground that may have a better pulse on the actual population, because nobody knows what is happening on the ground better than the folks who have been there the longest. And oftentimes civil society, they've been there for a long time, they've developed relationships with the local community. So even just inviting some of those organizations to the table, that's going to even get you a better picture, a more complete holistic picture of the situation on the ground. And that's really the other thing is, right, understanding what actually is the situation, getting a better pulse on the reality of the operational environment. And I think what we find is when we communicate very clearly the operational benefits of applying a gender perspective, we almost never get resistance because it's a mission-focused kind of priority.
Yeah. Can we have an amen? You just got it for me, because that's what the kind of people who take on jobs as military leaders, as police, rescue, whatever, they're committed to the mission. That doesn't change from culture to culture. And there are exceptions, but that's what draws them. And if you can show mission value, then your input will be accepted. As I told you on the phone, Monica, and some of our viewers know, I was blessed to be the director of the Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies for 5 years. And while I was there, true confession, women, peace, and security was my top priority because I saw the value. I had the Kool-Aid, whatever, and I know it works. I know it works, and there's data and science and all that stuff that shows it works. But to avoid the situation that we described, where it's a male-dominated environment and it's unusual to have women having a voice in security matters, we can do things like bring more women to the Asia Pacific Center. We more than doubled the participation of women. And what I think we have to do is normalize the participation of women, because it's quotas aren't the answer, and just having people in the room are not the answer. You have to normalize a legitimate input into the discussion. And do you do that as you travel around and do your exercises and engagement throughout the Indo-PACOM theater?
Yeah. So what we've kind of previously been talking about is what we would call the operationalization of women's security. And now we're talking about the other key pillar of our approach at US Indo-PACOM, which is the institutionalization, really looking within the organization. What are the policies, the procedures, what are the norms within an organization that may produce barriers to either women's inclusion, to their advancement or promotion? And you've identified a really great opportunity looking at those kinds of overseas educational and training kinds of opportunities. I think numerical targets can be helpful as a goal, but numerical metrics alone are not going to get us there because they don't tell us the whole story, right? They don't actually indicate, the number of women in a room doesn't indicate their level of meaningful participation. And meaningful participation really means that they can bring their whole authentic selves to the table and be equally respected members of the team, right? That they are not only at the table, but they're speaking. That they're not only speaking, but that they're listened to, that their ideas and thoughts are considered as equal to their male counterparts. And in some cases, that is a kind of cultural shift. And it really does require going deeper into just looking at numerical targets on their own.
There's a cultural shift in America, or has been. I mean, that's growth in society. I think we do better now. There's always room. But I think what you just described, it's not just deference to the women's perspective, to the gender-based perspective. It's also demand. I don't just... As a leader, I wouldn't want to just allow participation or facilitate. I want to demand input from the women and on an equal basis. This isn't all, in fact, it's not at all feel good. It's do good. And it works good. It works better. And we know that. As I told you when we talked, Monica, I saw evidence of the value of normalization at APCSS when we increased the participation of women and started asking the fellows, the course participants, to elect their own representative to speak at graduation. And we hadn't done that prior to that, but the amazing thing, not really amazing, just a good thing, as we normalized the participation of women, still male, predominantly male classes, 70 to 80% men, selected women to be their spokesperson, their representative, more than 50% of the time. So the women were performing, were respected, were expected to do well, and it was normal. And that normalization, I think, is really important. I see zeros on our clock. We've got this little clock here on the screen that tells me I've once again run over. Let me give you a last 30 seconds or however you need to, however much you need to put a wrap on your views on being the women, peace, and security spokesperson today for Indo-PACOM.
Sure. I would just say that, U.S. Indo-Pacific Command, we are always eager to partner with nations in the region on advancing women, peace, and security together. And notably, this framework, this perspective, this capability is not limited to women. Men can be trained as gender focal points, as gender advisors. Having men as allies in this work is also incredibly important. So again, I thank you for your advocacy and for the opportunity to speak here on behalf of U.S. Indo-Pacific Command.
Thank you, Monica. I do it for the mission. As I said, and you, that was a perfect segue to my closing, which is one more story from Asia, the Daniel K. Inouye Asia-Pacific Center for Security Studies. I've talked WPS at every opportunity, and once at a social event talking to fellows, I was giving my sermon again on why it works and its operational importance. And a male from a conservative society, conservative country, army colonel, and thus conservative as well, said to me, he said, "Director," and it was an epiphany. I witnessed the epiphany. He said, "This isn't just about women, is it? It's about including everybody." Dude, my work here is done. And our work here is done today. Thanks, Monica Herrera from IndoPaycom, and thanks to ThinkTech Hawaii. Folks, remember, it's a wonderful nonprofit that only gets by based on your support. So go to the website and give. And I'll be back in a couple of weeks subbing for Jay on the Chamber of Commerce Military Affairs Council, military in Hawaii. Mahalo and aloha.
Thank you so much for watching ThinkTech Hawaii. If you like what we do, please like us and click the subscribe button on YouTube and the follow button on Vimeo. You can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn, and donate to us at thinktechhawaii.com. Mahalo.